Support for NPR comes from this station and from American Express, proud supporter of the How I Built This Summit, taking place in San Francisco at the Yerba Buena Center this October 22nd and 23rd. Tickets and more information are at npr.org/summit. And from Westin Hotels and Resorts, offering a range of wellness options for guests, including their Eat Well menu, on-demand fitness gear lending program, and signature heavenly bed. Learn more at westin.com. A member of Marriott Bonvoy.
And welcome to WXPR Saturday Edition, a part of Weekend Edition on WXPR. We have three stories today about the Upper Peninsula, sandwiched between a visit with a wild rice researcher and an update about the School of the Arts. Sarah Dance is a second-year PhD student at UW-Madison. She's studying the effects of elevated levels of sulfate in surface water and what effect it has on the wild rice crop, traditional food for many people. Give us an idea about how broad and where wild rice is found.
Yeah, so it's all over the Great Lakes region. It's an incredibly unique plant. It's our only aquatic emergent grass. And so we have two species that are particular to here, Zevania aquatica and Zevania palustris. And there are two other kinds, but they don't grow here. But those are really important to this region. And they're mostly found across Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, a little bit in Illinois, and in Canada.
The range of wild rice has been diminishing a bit. In other words, there's less of it than, say, 100 years ago. Is that true?
Yes. So over the past 100 years, we've seen dramatic declines, about 32% decreases in occurrence in watersheds across Minnesota and Wisconsin. I've heard from wild rice managers and natural resource managers in the area that they've seen even further declines in the past 2 to 3 years.
Tell us how water quality is part of this. Tell us the importance of water quality for wild rice.
Yeah, so there's actually a lot of different things that can impact wild rice growth and survival in the area. There is a potential for sulfide mining to make a return to the area, and that will increase levels of sulfate in the overlying surface water. And it has been proven with many studies done in Minnesota that elevated sulfide conditions in the sediment pore water is the primary controller for wild rice. So if we see elevated levels of sulfate from sulfide mining, we will expect significant declines in our populations within the next 5 years. There's some other water quality parameters such as clarity and water level. So if the water level is too high, the wild rice can, you know, get drowned out. If it's too low, then it will also not be able to grow properly.
So you've been participating with a couple of tribes here in northern Wisconsin. Talk about that collaboration.
Yeah, so it's really just in its beginning phases. We've spoken with a lot of tribes. I particularly had the privilege of working with Wisconsin Sea Grant to learn about some of the concerns with wild rice growth and propagation in the state in creating an education and outreach toolkit. And I've just been a student assistant on that project. But through that project, I've met, you know, several interested individuals and entities that were wanted to collaborate with the university or at least begin some of those conversations so we could combine forces to look at some of the water quality and sediment quality parameters that were controlling wild rice growth and survival in that area. So, you know, in the past, there's been very little research done out of the university and very little attention across the state and within the different aspects of the university. Many of the professors I've spoken to that do water quality and sediment quality things within the state have no idea about wild rice. Many of the people that I've spoken to across the state weren't sure about the problem. So it's definitely at the beginning point of opening up the talks, creating an appropriate way to collaborate that is beneficial for the tribal folks in the area, rather than taking something and creating relationships that are only one-sided beneficial to the university.
Tell us what wild rice means to Native people.
Yeah, so it has meaning to a lot. I mean, it has meaning to many, many people in the state, and it has different meanings to different tribes. So for example, the Menominee, their name means the wild rice people. For some Ojibwe people, they see it as the origin story, the reason that they've come here. They were shown a vision that if they migrated to this area, that they would find food that grew on the water. So for some people, it's this sacred gift from the Creator. For others, it's this, and for those people as well as others, it's this really important food source. It's incredibly sustainable. If you harvest it and store it correctly, you can keep it for years. It's incredibly nutritious. It's the most nutritious native historical food, and it's actually the only grain that is gluten-free and has the most available protein. So it has significant value on a cultural and nutritional side.
Talk about the potential implications of opening a mine just across the border in Michigan.
Yeah, so that mine is, and I from the last news that I've heard about it, and it does change pretty rapidly. They had finally gotten all of their permits, and they were moving ahead with the project and doing some preliminary work. And it's right on that border between Wisconsin and the Upper Peninsula. So if, you know, open pit sulfide mining, regardless of the precautions that we take, is incredibly toxic. And it will increase the amount of sulfate we see going into the surface water. And while levels of sulfate in our surface water right now are relatively low, we will see those increases similar to how open pit sulfide mining has increased those levels in Minnesota. And we've seen it's very much correlated within the research that elevated level of sulfate does cause Minnowmen to go extinct in those areas. So, you know, some of the only surviving beds that we have in Wisconsin are actually within the northeastern region of the state. So we do see this potential for losing it entirely in the state if this goes forward. I definitely want to move forward with, the university's perspective and my perspective aren't the only one. I would love for people to check out thewayes.org, thewayes.org. That's a great resource from Native people, by Native people, and that really has a video on there showing the importance of wild rice.
Sarah Dance, doctoral student at UW-Madison. Next, Jim Skibo talks about neighborhoods and names.
I grew up in the UP, and like the listener, I've noticed that many towns have named neighborhoods, sometimes called locations. There are many reasons that a neighborhood could get a name, but if a town's origin was mining, it is likely that the neighborhood took the name of the nearby mine. The history of the Upper Peninsula of Michigan and its cultural landscapes are dominated by mining. Native Americans are the first to mine copper from the Keweenaw Peninsula, which they fashioned into tools that they used or traded throughout eastern North America. This practice dates back to at least 6,000 years ago. In 1841, soon after Michigan became a state, an extensive 100-mile-long copper deposit was mapped that extended through Douglas, Houghton, and Keweenaw counties. This led to a great copper boom, and most of the communities in this region were the result of the extraction, processing, or transportation of copper. By 1869, the copper country produced 95% of the nation's copper. Much of the copper rush was over by the early 20th century, though the White Pine Mine continued until 1995. Just as the copper boom started to fizzle out, three iron ranges were discovered. These are the Marquette-Menominee ranges in the central UP and the Gogebic in the western UP and northern Wisconsin. The city of Ironwood was one of the most prominent mining communities in the Gogebic region, and by the 1920s, the community had over 15,000 people. In 1891, Ironwood had six operating mines, including the Nori and the Aurora, which are also neighborhoods in today's Ironwood. Perhaps these neighborhoods inspired the listener's question. In many cases, these mines were operating before towns like Ironwood were established. Small communities would spring up around each mine. When towns like Ironwood were incorporated, they extended the boundaries to include these small mining settlements. In many cases, as the listener notes, these names have continued to the present, even though the mine closed long ago. Although the environment has slowly reclaimed the evidence of mining, keen observers can often see the remnants. Towns often have open pits, now filled with water, and tailings piles, which is what was left over after the ore was extracted. Some towns in the UP even have standing structures associated with the mines. The community architecture can also show traces of the mining companies. To attract workers, companies often build homes, which you can identify by their uniform shape even after 100 years of remodeling. The mines also built schools, hospitals, stores, and movie theaters, so mining communities will often have lasting evidence of their former mining days. We should be proud of our mining heritage, but it is important that we not overly romanticize the period. These mines have a complex social history. It is true that they provided employment for immigrants who fled war-torn and economically depressed Europe, but the mines, especially in the early days, had little concern for worker safety. Serious injury occurred daily, and death was commonplace. In 1909, the Norrie mine was considered the greatest iron mine in the world in terms of ore production. Yet, on May 13, 1912, 7 men were killed in a cave-in at this mine right in Ironwood. Appreciating our mining history does not mean we cannot also understand this period in its fuller context. For WXPR News, this is Jim Skibo.
And up next, Larry LaPonchin talks about Andrew Carnegie and the influence on a library.
This then is spoiled to be the duty of the man of wealth. First, to set an example of modest, unostentatious living.
This Sunday, August 11th, will mark the 100-year anniversary of the death of Andrew Carnegie. The Scottish-born American who grew up poor became one of the most successful businessmen by revolutionizing the steel industry in the United States. When Carnegie sold his steel company to J.P. Morgan in 1901, he became one of the richest men in the world. Carnegie then gave away most of his fortune to fund philanthropic endeavors such as education, international peace, and public libraries. One public library in the city of Ironwood, Michigan, became one of Carnegie's earliest recipients. As Library Director Lynn Wierzynski explains, Andrew Carnegie had keen interest and historical ties to the Ironwood area.
Actually, Carnegie was approached in the form of a letter from James Gailey, who was the vice president of Carnegie's steel company at the time. And he asked Carnegie for the funding to begin a small library here. And he asked for it in our principal mining operation town in the Lake Superior region.
The Lake Superior region contained high-grade iron ore, a main ingredient in manufactured iron and steel. To help ensure an abundant supply of this crucial raw material, Andrew Carnegie, in 1892, bought controlling interest of the Norrie and Pabst mines in Ironwood. He also invested in Great Lake freighters, in railroads, to secure the complete transportation of this iron ore to his steel factories around Pittsburgh. Carnegie never had to purchase iron ore on the open market again.
So Carnegie very willingly sent $12,000 to begin the library. Later, he was asked for $5,000 more, and there was no hesitation in him giving that additional $5,000. The library itself was built in 1901, and it was actually the first library in Michigan to receive a grant for a public library from Andrew Carnegie. We're actually the oldest continually operating Carnegie in the state of Michigan. So we're very proud of that.
Once the library opened its doors in 1902, the Ironwood community was then entirely responsible for all future library costs, including staffing, buying books, and maintaining the building. In 2011, with the library in desperate need of repairs, it became part of the National Register of Historic Places. The library could now apply for grant money to help restore the building to its original architectural charm and character.
And when you look around the building, much of the woodwork, almost all of it, is still the original woodwork. The radiators and the grills that you see are all the original from the building. The high ceilings upstairs, the archway above our front desk is original. When you look at the outside architecture, the sandstone sills, the cornices, the corbels, the whole building is so beautiful, and it was falling into a state of disrepair. So what you see in our library, much of it is what you would have seen when you walked in the day we opened.
Despite Carnegie's enormous charitable donations, however, some people remain critical for his harsh treatment toward the working man. For example, Carnegie continually broke labor unions, forcing his employees to work longer hours for reduced or stagnant wages. Lynn experienced this point of view firsthand when the library hosted a program called Andrew Carnegie Day in conjunction with the Smithsonian's The Way We Worked exhibit.
And a tourist came in, or someone who was visiting the area one morning, and when he saw it, he, in no uncertain terms, told me what he thought of Andrew Carnegie and what Andrew Carnegie did to the working man and what a horrible man he actually was. I was a little taken back, but I just gently told him that we all recognize that, but we also knew that he did give money to libraries and did have the good of people in his heart when it came to that. So we prefer to just kind of remember him here as being the man who funded libraries.
Nearly 100 years after his death, Lynn reflects on what Andrew Carnegie might think of the public library in Ironwood that still bears his name today.
I think he'd be proud. You know, we're still here. We've done everything that we can in this community to make sure this library still is operating. And I think he'd be very proud to see that we are still here and still doing exactly what he set out to do. We're a place that believes in not only learning, but also in being a place where people feel they can come and relax. We call ourselves the community's living room, a place to provide entertainment, recreation, and just to feel safe and at home.
There are two murals in downtown Ironwood that depict and honor local miners. Often working long hours in dangerous environments, many of these miners were first-generation immigrants from Italy, Finland, and Eastern Europe. They left their country of origin looking and hoping for a better life and a promising future. It's these miners who extracted the iron ore that helped build Andrew Carnegie's empire and fortune. And I believe it's these miners, along with Andrew Carnegie, who helped build the Ironwood Carnegie Library, that for over a century has been a bedrock for the community. For WXPR News, I'm Larry Lepachin.
And next, Mackenzie Martin takes a trip out to find whether the Paulding Light is myth or fact.
It's a dark, clear night just outside of Paulding, Michigan, and 12 cars are lining up on both sides of a dead-end road. They're here to see the Paulding Light, an intensely bright white light that appears at the top of a distant hill multiple times every night. Paulding is a small, unincorporated community that's part of a town of just more than 200 residents. Needless to say, most nights there's not a lot going on. Some here tonight have seen the light before. Others, like Rich Henrian from Norway, Michigan, drove 80 miles to try to see the light for the first time.
I have three grandkids, 6, 8, and 10, who are quite intrigued by this. So I got to check it out myself and make sure it's not too scary.
Aaron Halverson is here for the second time from Presque Isle, Wisconsin. He first came as a child 30 years ago.
I remember my grandpa he saw it coming at us and he just threw the car in reverse and got out of here.
A local legend goes that it's a lantern held by the ghost of a fallen railroad brakeman. But in 2010, a group of student researchers from nearby Michigan Tech University investigated the light with a telescope. After cross-referencing it with traffic on a highway nearly 5 miles away, they concluded that the basis of the spectacle was actually car headlights. One of the researchers, Jeremy Boss, is now an assistant professor at Michigan Tech. He says that research wasn't exactly embraced by everyone.
It's ranged from stories coming back to me of folks in Paulding wanting to run me out of town and not being welcome there, to people saying, do I want to tell their kids there's no Easter Bunny? But at the same time, there's a lot of other people who even said, thank you. You know, I've always told people when I go there that it's obviously car headlights and they don't believe me.
The Paulding Light has drawn thousands of tourists to Paulding, especially in recent years. Paulding General Store owner Michelle Strong says she directs tourists to the light on a daily basis and dedicates a third of her store to Paulding Light merchandise, claiming the mystery is still unsolved. She says some people don't want to know what's causing it.
There are people who don't want to have an answer to it and want to enjoy the fun part of it. There are other folks who are uncomfortable with not knowing, so they have to give it an answer.
Dude, look at that thing now. It's all.
Can we go up to it?
For an hour and 15 minutes, we watch the light appear and then go away. Aaron Halverson isn't very impressed.
Wait. Why is it moving?
Then suddenly the light appears to move up and down and red lights appear. It's over in an instant, but it changes Halvorsen's entire perception.
That wasn't car lights. Yeah, I have no idea what I saw. That was pretty freaky.
Others aren't so sure.
It almost looked like police pulling somebody over, didn't it?
Michigan Tech's Jeremy Boss says it basically comes down to confirmation bias. He thinks people see what they're already looking for.
We have myths and fables, and they're valuable to us as humans, and there's no reason the Paulding Light can't be one of those. But, you know, to say that there's no explanation for it, I may have wanted to say that there is, if you're looking for one, and give people that option.
Based on the last half century, it's unlikely there will be consensus on the cause of the light. To form your own opinion, you'll have to drive up to Paulding, Michigan. For NPR News, I'm Mackenzie Martin.
And our arts segment has Art Start in Rhinelander's Ashley McLaughlin, and she hopes people come out to the School of the Arts next month in Tomahawk.
Yeah, so Art Start is one of the co-hosts of Project North, which is a downtown Rhinelander music, art, and sustainability festival. And as part of that, we are also hosting our third year of the School of the Arts program, which is a bunch of art classes held at the University of Wisconsin Treehaven campus in Tomahawk. So for 3 years, we've had about 50 students or more from all over the state gather and take a conglomeration of different art classes, everything from writing to fiber art and fiber dyeing classes, a little bit for everybody to just kind of experiment and learn from one another and gather together, and all at a beautiful setting in the Northwoods at the Treehaven campus.
I think if someone has been familiar with School of the Arts, it's different than what it used to be. Can you talk about where it is now compared to where it was?
School of the Arts program has been a 50-year tradition that the University of Wisconsin-Madison Continuing Studies program started many years ago, and in its final days, around 2015 or so, it was attended by hundreds of people in Rhinelander here. And it was really artists gathering to teach other artists. It was really a unique program, and it just kind of dwindled because the local partnerships weren't there. We have been working with the University of Wisconsin-Madison Continuing Studies Department to bring the program back kind of on a smaller scale, but still stay true to School of the Arts and the meaning of the program, and just kind of put an Art Start spin on it. Art Start is a very small nonprofit organization, so we aren't able to handle it on as grand of a scale as it once was, but we're rekindling the program and adding a little bit of freshness to it, so it's not as traditional as it used to be, but more innovative and more open to what people want.
I guess tell us some of the things people can get involved with.
Yeah, so we have several classes. All of this is online now. Registration opened on July 31st, I believe it was. All of this information can be found at artstartrhinelander.org. I have our full program up there. But you're looking at about 6 classes per day, everything again from fiber art classes to screenwriting to writing poetry, reading poetry and sharing, to collage classes, and pretty much everything you can imagine. That we have field sketching, dry point prints, and nature. We actually also have a visiting Japanese artist that is going to be teaching a couple classes at School of the Arts this year. So a little bit of everybody, really. But we have 6 classes in the morning every day from September 27th through 29th. You can choose to come and treat this as a retreat, so you can stay on the Treehaven campus. You can sign up for meals, or you can just pop in and out at your leisure if you have just one class that you want to attend. Registration remains open until the class starts. So if you drop in, you decide, I took one class, but I really think I want to take this other one, oh, you can still attend the class. So it's a small program, and being small, we have a little bit of flexibility to be able to do that. But September 27th through September 29th, the classes run from 9 a.m. until noon every morning. And then in the afternoon, we have a open studio time where artists can get together and share with other artists. They can mingle, they can talk, they can work on their projects if they want to. I imagine some of the instructors will still be on the campus. They kind of join in with the students and have this really intimate, if the classes really have an intimate feel where instructors are just kind of around so you can ask them questions. They learn from the participants and the participants learn from the instructors as well. So
if somebody got all excited over what you just said, where can they register? Where can they find out more information?
Yep, everything is available online at artstartrhinelander.org. You can also give us a call at ArtStart, 715-362-4328.
That's ArtStart and Rhinelander's Ashley McLaughlin, and she hopes people come out for School of the Arts. That's it for WXPR Saturday edition. Stay tuned for Polka. I'm Ken Krall.